Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, December 19, 2013, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group teleforum conference call. The topic for today's call is the district court decision earlier this week in the NSA data collection case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording today's call for the possible use as a podcast in the future. And we welcome today two experts, both who have been following this case and I trust have read the decision. We're going to hear first from Stephen G. Bradbury. He's the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel to the U.S. Department of Justice and now a partner at the law firm of Deckert right here in Washington, D.C. He'll be followed by Professor Orrin S. Kerr. He is the Fred C. Stevenson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. We're going to get opening remarks of about 6 to 8 minutes or so from each. And then, as always, we're going to turn to you for your questions. So please be ready with those questions. And with that, Mr. Bradbury, the floor is yours.
Dean, thank you very much. I thought I'd just take a few minutes to set the stage by describing Judge Leon's opinion for the district court in D.C. and offer some thoughts on it by way of criticism. I think it's fair to say I do not agree with the opinion. And then I would turn it over to Orrin, who I think is going to take a bit of a deeper dive on some of the insights from the opinion and his thoughts. So Judge Leon's ruling was in a civil case brought by Larry Klayman of Freedom Watch and a number of other plaintiffs, one other plaintiff named named Charles Strange. And these are the two plaintiffs who got the relief from Judge Leon's opinion. And they were challenging some of the NSA programs or alleged programs that were the subject or have been the subject of the Snowden disclosures. And one program in particular was the subject of Judge Leon's ruling, and that is the telephone metadata collection. And this is the program conducted through an order approved by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court, under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is part of the FISA statute. It's the business records provision that enables the FBI to acquire business records, records held by companies, for example, where it shows that the records are relevant to a counterterrorism investigation. And the FISA court can approve the government's obtaining of those records. And under that authority, this is the authority that the NSA has used to acquire vast amounts of telephone metadata from phone companies, which it uses to try to track and discover the connections, the calling connections for numbers that are associated with foreign terrorist organizations as part of counterterrorism investigations of those of the threats that those organizations pose to the United States. And this metadata collection consists simply of telephone numbers. It's tables of numbers that shows what phone number has called what number, when, the date and time of the communication, and the duration. So it doesn't include any substance of communications. It doesn't enable the NSA to listen in on calls, et cetera. And then the NSA simply does focused queries into the database when it has a phone number that is associated with a foreign terrorist organization to try to discover whether the persons using that phone number, the suspected terrorists, are communicating, for example, with somebody in the United States. And that enables the NSA to put together patterns and connections that help them discover new leads, new phone numbers that may be used by the terrorists. Larry Klayman and Charles Strange don't claim that they're terrorists who are likely the subject of NSA surveillance, but rather they claim that their Fourth Amendment rights were violated simply by the fact that they are telephone subscribers. They subscribe to Verizon as telephone customers, and therefore, presumably, their phone numbers appear in these tables of numbers that get transmitted to the NSA. They also challenged the FISA court's issuance of the order as a violation of the statute. Judge Leon said that he did not have jurisdiction to address the statutory question, but he did reach the Fourth Amendment issue. And he first held that these two plaintiffs, simply by virtue of the fact that they subscribed to phone service from Verizon, had standing to challenge this metadata program. And then he went on and reached addressed the Fourth Amendment issues. And this was in the posture of a preliminary injunction motion. So this is not a definitive ruling on the merits, but he did have to reach the conclusion that the plaintiffs had a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, and that's what he found. He concluded that these plaintiffs had a reasonable expectation of privacy in their own telephone metadata, which again is simply their own phone numbers and records of when they called and who called them. That conclusion meant, in Judge Leon's opinion, that any collection of this metadata by the government constituted a search for Fourth Amendment purposes. And of course, usually when you have a search under the Fourth Amendment, the default is that the government, the agency, the investigator has to get a warrant approved by a court and supported by probable cause in order to conduct that search, if there really is a search that invades someone's reasonable expectation of privacy. Judge Leon went on, though, to address whether this case might constitute an exception to the warrant requirement, even if it is a search, under a doctrine called the special uses doctrine, which says there are certain circumstances involving special uses where the government's interest is so high and so specific some administrative area. And that government interest significantly outweighs whatever infringement of privacy interest is involved, that in certain circumstances the search could be reasonable even if it doesn't have even if it's not supported by a warrant. And again, Judge Leon here concluded that the plaintiffs had a reasonable had a substantial likelihood of success in showing that the collection of metadata that included their telephone metadata was not supported by the special uses doctrine. And so based on that line of reasoning, the judge concluded that they were likely to succeed in showing that the collection is unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment. And merely because there are constitutional rights involved, he held that they had shown enough of an irreparable harm that he granted their motion to enjoin the NSA program to the extent that involved their numbers. So what he was requiring was he issued an order that would require the NSA not to collect or retain any of the telephone metadata from these two individual plaintiffs. Of course, he pretty much made it clear there's nothing to distinguish these two plaintiffs from any other telephone customers. So pretty clear the upshot of that is any other similarly situated telephone customer could come into this court and ask this judge for a preliminary injunction, and presumably would get one if he had a case before Judge Leon. I think fortunately, recognizing how out of line his decision is with all of the relevant precedents here, which I'll mention in a second, and how dramatic an effect this would have on this major national security program, Judge Leon stayed his own decision pending appeal. So Presumably the government will appeal, and this will be decided by the D.C. Circuit next in a Court of Appeals ruling. Let me offer some brief thoughts on Judge Leon's analysis. On the reasonable expectation of privacy, Judge Leon explained that he believed the controlling Supreme Court decision here, which is the Smith versus Maryland decision from 1979, is in effect obsolete, if you will, as applied to the new age of smartphones and cell phone technology. In the Smith case, the Supreme Court held that the police could use a pen register on a suspect's telephone line without a warrant, and a pen register tells the police what phone numbers the suspect has been calling and when he's called them. It's the very same, exact same metadata that's at issue here, and in Smith, the Supreme Court said that telephone users do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that metadata, because when you pick up a phone and dial a number, that is information you're communicating to the phone company for the phone company to use in completing the call, and the company generates that data in the ordinary course of its business and uses it to bill you for the call, to resolve billing disputes, et cetera. It's not your data. It's not your private data. It doesn't reveal anything about private communications. It's simply business records of the phone company, and you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that information. And all the other courts, including 14 different federal judges on the FISA court, have concluded that that opinion controls the metadata program here and makes it constitutional because there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in this data. Judge Leon said, well, modern times with smartphones are very different from 1979 in the Smith case, and also the vastness and indiscriminate nature of this collection meant that this is a different context, because the NSA could at least potentially build up a profile of a lot of information about an individual, and therefore this does involve a reasonable expectation of privacy. I think that decision is – I don't see any support for that decision, and I don't find the distinctions from the Smith case at all persuasive. If anything, I would say that the vastness and indiscriminate nature of this collection minimizes even further any potential expectation of privacy in this data, because the individual's data is subsumed within the vast anonymous data set with millions of other telephone users' data, and the chance that any particular individual's data is actually going to be reviewed by an analyst is really vanishingly small in this context. So Judge Leon also cited the recent Jones case involving GPS tracking. I don't think that case is at all germane here. I think I'm going to probably turn it over to Oren now, who may well have further thoughts on the Jones case and also perhaps on the special uses doctrine discussion that Judge Leon addressed. But I think I've used more than my allotted time. So, Oren, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Steve. I wanted to offer a couple thoughts on Judge Leon's opinion. First, I wanted to start with how striking and unusual an opinion it is. This is an emotional opinion. It's a passionate opinion. Judge Leon is angry, and he's using italics. He's using exclamation marks. He's not just saying he finds the government, the reliance on the leading Supreme Court case unpersuasive. He's saying it's absurd, it's outrageous, it's sort of obvious that of course he cannot follow the Supreme Court's decision in Smith versus Maryland. It's a remarkable opinion for the degree of emotion and passion. Now, if you oppose the program, probably people say, well, that's great. That's a judge being human. And on the other hand, it seems to me that as a legal matter, a lot of Judge Leon's legal arguments are not very persuasive. So the combination of the relatively unpersuasive legal arguments and the emotion has a different reaction if you look at it from a different perspective. But it's a really striking and unusual opinion, and as Steve pointed out, one that really cuts across the grain of other case law that's out there. To my mind, the most obvious weak link in Judge Leon's opinion is how he tries to distinguish Smith versus Maryland. Now, Smith versus Maryland is not a popular decision in some circles, but it is the law. It's what the Supreme Court has said. And Judge Leon's argument is that you can't follow a telephone case from 1979 because the world is so different today. We use telephones differently today than we did in 1979. And in particular, we have cell phones, which are multi-use computers and can be used in so many different ways that we think of computers differently. We think of cell phones and phones differently than we did in the 70s. You can't possibly follow telephone cases from 1979 because that's just a generation ago. And I don't think the argument works for a couple reasons. One of them is it's really not up to a district judge to say when Supreme Court decisions have effectively expired in their reasoning. It's sort of that's not his job. That's the Supreme Court's job to say, for example, in Katz, we overturn Olmstead. The role of the public telephone is different today than it was in the 1920s. We changed the law. That's really a job for the Supreme Court to do, not for an individual trial judge to do. And then more broadly, the actual surveillance that's occurring in this case is only the same kind of surveillance that was at issue in Smith versus Maryland. It was numbers dialed, connections of a phone line, and it was not the kind of extra functions that cell phones have. So the fact that we think of cell phones today as different from what phones were in 1979, it's not at all clear how that's even relevant to the question of whether Smith versus Maryland is good law, because in Smith versus Maryland, it was the same kind of information that was being collected. And Judge Leon concedes it's the same kind of information. He's just sort of saying we're in a different world now, and that sort of frees him from the Supreme Court Smith versus Maryland case. So I didn't find that effort to distinguish Smith versus Maryland at all persuasive. With that said, Judge Leon does have an argument to be made, which I don't think he makes very well, but I think we can make better, relying on the D.C. Circuit's case United States versus Maynard, which was left on the books when the Supreme Court decided United States versus Jones. Jones and Maynard are the same case, just a different name before the Supreme Court. And in United States versus Jones, the Supreme Court did not address the issue of whether long-term surveillance might be a search when short-term surveillance is not, at least in the majority opinion. But there were concurring opinions which suggested this theory, and it was a view that the D.C. Circuit had adopted in the Maynard case. So Judge Leon's best argument to craft as to why this kind of monitoring would be a search is that there's the long-term scale of the monitoring is different from, say, a typical case. So, for example, a typical pen register monitoring might be a week or 30 days or 90 days or 180 days. On the other hand, it appears that the government collects these records for a matter of years. So maybe there's some line that's crossed where over some period of time, maybe 10 days of monitoring is okay, but at some point, the monitoring becomes a search. Now, this is a novel idea. It's what I've called the mosaic theory of the Fourth Amendment, but it was suggested, or adopted rather, by the D.C. Circuit in United States versus Maynard. And in Maynard, the D.C. Circuit said that when the government tracks an individual around, putting a GPS device on their car, at some point they begin to get so much information about a person that it's so invasive that it becomes a search. So monitoring somebody in the short term, putting a GPS device on their car and watching them for, say, a day, that's not a search. But by the time you get to 28 days, that is a search, and we don't know where the dividing line might be. This is a very novel view of the Fourth Amendment, and it's potentially a dramatic game changer in all of surveillance law. Because what it does is it says that conduct which had been thought to be constitutional might actually be unconstitutional if paired with other constitutional conduct. So you can actually say, you know, one constitutional act, not a search, is fine. A second one is fine, both of those in isolation. But if you look at them together, collectively they become a search. Well, if you're talking about surveillance on a broad scale, which is, of course, what the national security state is all about, in that case, then perhaps everything is a search. Perhaps watching somebody in public for more than a few minutes becomes a search. Perhaps pen register surveillance becomes a search. Perhaps obtaining somebody's credit card records becomes a search. Perhaps looking at their phone records becomes a search. Everything might be a search. It's potentially a dramatic shift that is really going to destabilize the future of Fourth Amendment law in some pretty dramatic ways. What makes this difficult is that we have the D.C. Circuit's Maynard case from 2010 We have the concurring opinions in Jones, which suggests something like what the D.C. Circuit did without going into any detail. And yet we don't have any idea what the answers are to all of these possible explanations of how this mosaic approach might apply to all the other facts that are important and significant and that we'd want to know about. Judge Leon talks a little bit about this mosaic idea. I don't think he really makes the argument as effectively as he could. But what's going to happen now on appeal is that the D.C. Circuit is going to have an opportunity to either embrace this mosaic idea, distinguish the mosaic idea, maybe reject the mosaic idea en banc. We just don't know, but that's a big issue that the D.C. Circuit is going to be able to consider on the merits. I wanted to flag two other issues. One is that it's not clear that the D.C. Circuit is going to reach the merits because there have been some significant arguments made that Judge Leon was wrong in reaching the merits under the injunction standard. So Judge Leon says, you know, I think this program isn't working and it's important to follow the Constitution. I enjoin the program. At the same time, there's a recent Supreme Court case from 2008, Winters versus NRDC, which suggested that in the national security space, judges should be very reluctant to enjoin government conduct involving national security. So this is a fairly recent Supreme Court case. And it's entirely possible that the D.C. Circuit on appeal will say, whatever the merits are, we're not going to allow an injunction here, sending the case back down without reaching the merits, although based on Judge Leon's opinion in the district court, I think we can predict that he'd be back before too long with a merits opinion. So that it may just delay the inevitable. But that's at least one possible way the D.C. Circuit could try to avoid this issue on the merits in the initial appeal. Finally, I wanted to flag the issue of the reasonableness of the conduct. So after Judge Leon concludes that there's a search in the NSA's program, sort of construed broadly, he then considers the question of whether it's a reasonable or unreasonable search. Of course, it's only a Fourth Amendment violation if it's an unreasonable search. And what's somewhat puzzling in how Judge Leon goes about the reasonableness determination is he says reasonableness normally requires some sort of weighing of cost and benefit. How invasive is this to privacy and how much does it help the government? At the Supreme Court level, the Supreme Court has been careful to say that measuring the benefit to the government, that side of the equation, has to be done as kind of an absolute question, not relative to other law enforcement techniques. So if you're trying to argue that a particular government step is unreasonable, say it's like a roadblock looking for immigration violations, you can't say it's unreasonable because there are other ways of catching immigration violations that would work just as well. In other words, there's no least restrictive alternative requirement in Fourth Amendment law. Judge Leon, on the other hand, when he analyzes the reasonableness of the program, he says, well, I don't think this really works. The government has not proved to me, based on the public record and what they've wanted to show to me, enough evidence that the NSA surveillance program is effective for me to conclude that it is reasonable. And he does that by saying, yes, you've caught a bunch of terrorists, and in fact, you've caught terrorists using this program, but I'm not convinced that this program was the key. I'm not convinced that you're able to do better with this program, at least substantially better, than you are without this program. So that's his, sort of the underpinning of his – effectively, he's saying it's reasonable if it's a good idea. He's not persuaded that this is a good idea. I don't think the Supreme Court doctrine points that way. As I said, I think it requires much more of an absolute scale rather than a relative scale. So that's another issue that the D.C. Circuit is going to potentially grapple with if they do reach the merits of this case on appeal. And if I could just offer a broad perspective on this case, you know – on one hand, what Judge Leon has done, he's cut across the grain of the other cases. So there's a bunch of cases saying that basically the surveillance is fine. And Judge Leon cuts across the grain, and the way it always works, and we saw this with the Obamacare litigation, interestingly, a few years ago. If you have a bunch of district court cases that say a government program's okay and one that says it's not okay, the one that says it's not okay gets an incredible amount of media attention. Everybody says, oh, my gosh, because now, you know, it only takes one judge to upset the upset the understanding of what's allowed and what's not allowed. What this really does is start a conversation, start the appellate process, sort of try to make those arguments more credible because a district judge, at least one federal judge, has agreed with these arguments. It changes the public debate and it queues up more cases, but it's not obvious that the D.C. Circuit is going to be particularly persuaded by what the one judge has said in the trial court. So this opinion has gotten an incredible amount of press attention, and it is a remarkable opinion, but it's just a single district court, and now we head up to the Court of Appeals. And with that, I'll pass it back to you, Dean.
Thank you so much. Let's turn to the audience. We've got quite a few people on the phone. In a moment, everybody's going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts or both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I'm going to let folks know that we tried to recruit as a panelist a couple of speakers who would be perhaps more sympathetic to Judge Leon's opinion, and we weren't able to do that. So I encourage folks to ask questions critical of our panelists today. And before we turn to the audience, let me say that we have managed to schedule a call for tomorrow at 1 p.m. When we'll be discussing the Volcker Rule, which is a controversy in its own circles. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, sort of the year in review, I want to let folks know, I want to thank the audiences for attending our teleforum calls of the Federalist Society. We've done over 120 of them this year. Almost all of them have been recorded and are available on the Federalist Society's website under the podcasts page. And with that, it looks like we've got quite a few callers, so let's go to our first question.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski, an attorney in New York. Was any consideration given to data mining and data analytics in the decision? With enough computing power, it would be very easy to quickly identify the names associated with every one of those telephone calls using reverse directories, which are available for free online, find out with a high degree of certainty for a vast majority, probably into the 90% range of confidence, the person's identity, sexual orientation, political affiliation, whether they vote, religion, where they go to church, if they're having an affair, approximately how much money they make, where they go on vacation, their personal habits, which also can be used, as the casinos do very effectively, and certain retailers, in predictive analytics as well. So while historically just having telephone numbers and date and time of call by itself wouldn't be a big deal, the fact that that can now be combined with publicly available information, which is readily accessible and high capacity computing power, the government could know virtually everything about every citizen. That seems quite invasive to me.
So this program, clearly combining any information with any other program begins to take on a broader take. That's sort of the argument of the mosaic, right? Is that yes, this in isolation is one thing, but what about when you combine it with other potential ways of finding out other information?
All of those other ways are perfectly permissible in and of themselves and are matters of public record. Most states' voter registration and party affiliations public record. The amount of your mortgage is a matter of public record. People have all sorts of stuff that's available on Facebook. There's items with data mining.
I understand all of those points. Private parties are able to get a tremendous amount of information on other private parties, and I can understand from a policy standpoint that that could enhance, in theory, any other piece of information. I recognize that concern both in the private sector with respect to individual police officers and with the NSA. I get that. In this opinion, that argument makes a slight appearance when Judge Leon is distinguishing Smith versus Maryland. He suggests that Smith versus Maryland is that was in the 70s before there was great ways of analyzing data, but today we have better ways of analyzing data, and so Smith versus Maryland is undermined by that technological change, not talking about linking it too much to other sources of data. One trick in this case, though, is that there's no evidence that Clayman's own numbers were queried. So Clayman's arguing that his information was searched because it was collected and put into the database, not because his number was actually analyzed. So So that doesn't make too much of an appearance in the opinion because he's not claiming that any of that occurred.
Well, there may be a ripeness issue. The government is poised to be able to do this on a moment's notice, but it hasn't happened yet. And, of course, the government's probably not going to announce that we're now deciding to build profiles based on their political leanings for political purposes using all this data. I mean,
I agree that there's a ripeness. I mean, this is actually kind of goes to the standing issue. If you take what is a Fourth Amendment search to be not the collection of the phone numbers into the database, but rather the analysis in order to create some sort of an understanding of what somebody did, then in that case, Klayman does not have standing under the Clapper decision to bring his challenge. So yeah, the court has to take...
Analogy, though, it's like the police having a gun pointed at your head and saying, well, don't worry, I'm not going to shoot, and you won't have a problem unless I shoot. I don't intend to, but it's lurking there as a serious
I suppose it depends if you're charging somebody with murder for not actually firing the gun. That may be appropriate. I mean, the Supreme Court was clear in a case called Caro that when analyzing Fourth Amendment questions, you don't consider the potential of what a technological device could do. You have to actually look at what the technological device has done. So I think it's consistent with current Fourth Amendment law to take that wait and see approach. But I understand you may not find that as satisfying an option as the court did in the Caro case.
Not trusting the government entirely, I find this, what the NSA doing is troubling. Anyway, I don't want to take up more time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Matthew Christ, pardon me, a lawyer in Virginia. And I used to do a lot of tech work, and I was in the military in communications, and I wanted to correct an error earlier. Metadata on cell phones actually do contain location data. It's not as accurate as a GPS, but it does record what cell towers you're connecting to. So that is a little bit more, I think.
In this case, though, the government has said that they are not collecting location information as part of the program. Judge Leon, in a footnote, suggests that he thinks the government may be lying based on some, he's suspicious that they're lying, but he says that nothing in his opinion hinges on that issue. So effectively, we can take his opinion as entering a ruling, assuming no location information collected.
I understand that, and that was going to be one of my points that I wanted to make. I doubt that I'm alone in believing that the NSA is a fully truthful organization, and so it wouldn't be difficult for them to equivocate location data with cell tower data. You see, so location data is GPS data. They're going to make that equivocation, whereas in reality, the doublespeak. They're leaving out the fact that they are collecting which cell tower you're connecting to. I don't think that's outside of the realm of possibility.
This is Steve.
They have said they're not collecting that as part of this program, but there are a number of court cases that have actually applied the Smith principle to uphold the gathering of cell tower location data without a search warrant. So I think the same analysis actually would apply to cell tower location data. And one interesting thing I think, interesting to me anyway, is back in the day of Smith, it was all landline phones, and
mm-hmm.
Judge Leon makes a big point of saying cell phones, this is a whole new ball game because cell phones. And one of the things he points out in the footnote, although he doesn't say it applies here, is this location information. But if you think about it, back in 1979, in the age of landline phones, if you knew the landline phone number, you knew it.
You know the location.
Because they were all, as in fact Judge Leon points out in his footnote, they were all tied to a building, a particular location. And so you did have location information from pen register readouts in the old days of pure landline phones.
But I'd like to challenge you on that point there. Don't you see that what you just said actually exacerbates the constitutional violation of the NSA's program, because instead of knowing where a person lives and then getting a warrant about tapping that person's line, instead we're now surveilling everyone and able to search people without any warrant whatsoever on the individual. You see, instead of knowing where the person is and then telling a judge where they are and going and searching that person's line, we now can search everybody, put a GPS tracker on everybody. And it is effectively a GPS. That's the other thing I wanted to say. This is essentially a global positioning system that the NSA is able to do with cell tower data. That's what I wanted to get to, is this is essentially a GPS from the NSA on every single American citizen.
Yeah, this database does not include cell phone tower data, though.
And, I don't believe that. I don't.
But,
I am incredulous.
But there is this fundamental principle, which I think still stands under Supreme Court precedent, and the other courts of appeals have applied it, that if you're talking about business records that are kept in the ordinary course and not under the control of an individual, and like the types of data here that the phone companies generate in order to conduct their business, and we're not talking about private information about a call or the contents of a call, it's information that the system has to generate, and the users of the system understand that, then you still get back to the fundamental question of whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy in that data. And if there is, and if it does require a search warrant, then and you know, maybe this is a desirable result from the perspective of, for example, a strong libertarian. But the result, the upshot of that would be that lots of production of materials that is conducted under administrative subpoenas could not occur. So if, for example, you have administrative agencies doing investigations in the securities area, in the antitrust area, et cetera, they get large amounts of information, including databases, through administrative subpoenas or discovery requests, and without court approval, without a search warrant, and that information can contain a lot of private information about individuals and their activities. That the agency can then, and the agency can search that database in connection with an investigation, for example. And it's that principle or that construct that is behind this business records provision of the FISA statute. And if that doesn't work constitutionally, then there are that creates huge issues in lots of areas, not just in the area of national security. And I guess the last thing I'd say on that is that in the area of national security, the mission of the NSA to try to protect the country from foreign attack is, of course, as important to anyone, whether you're libertarian or not, as any function that government could possibly perform, is the one essential function, national defense. And so the interest in doing it in this particular context would be much greater than any other agency in any other regulatory context.
Okay, thank you. Those are fair points. Can I ask one follow-up question?
Can I ask you, this is Dean Reuter, can I ask you to punch back in if you would? We've got eight people lined up. I want to make sure we try and get to as many people as possible, but I
thank
welcome
you,
to call later. Thanks. Looks like we just lost the next caller, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Chris Danessa. Hello, Steve, and hello, Professor Kerr. I have a question of what you both make of the fact that Judge Leon seemingly completely ignored the fact that the FISC judges, sometimes explicitly and sometimes or every time implicitly, ruled on the constitutionality of the election. And there seems to be no discussion of that whatsoever in his opinion, which seems odd to me, and I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I did find that extremely odd. I mean, he did acknowledge that 14 different federal judges, including several who sit on the same district court as he does, had previously approved this program, in fact, 35 times, and each of those approvals implicitly included a conclusion that it continued to be consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And he didn't address the inconsistency there. However, on page 63 of his opinion, he did expressly note that his holding was in conflict with holdings of other courts. Though he didn't mention the FISA court holdings, he did mention there's a district judge's ruling from just a month ago out in San Diego. A federal district judge upheld the metadata program under the Fourth Amendment as consistent with the Fourth Amendment under Smith. And then he cites a couple of other district court opinions, including one from Judge Urbina in the D.C. District Court, upholding the acquisition of cell tower locational data under the Smith analysis. So he does acknowledge that his opinion is in conflict, but curiously, he doesn't address the fact that the FISA court, which is a court of Article III district judges, has the authority in the first instance to pass on these questions of constitutionality. And he seemed to view them as a court that, if you will, doesn't really count in this whole equation. It's very interesting, I thought.
Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Bill James, and the question is more fundamental relative to the mission of the federal government as prescribed by the preamble, which is to defend liberty as opposed to case law. And if there's a choice between defending liberty and saving my life, the federal government is supposed to defend liberty. And then the problem with all these searches is they put in an unlimited time that they can go back and go through all of this stored data at any given time to come up with new ways to prosecute behaviors that were not necessarily legal or illegal before. I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, well, I would say that in this particular case, this program of metadata collection is subject to pretty strict limitations under the court order. They do retain the data for 5 years. It gets purged after 5 years, but they can only access it for the purpose of tracking phone numbers that are associated with foreign terrorist organizations as part of a counterterrorism investigation of those organizations and the threat they pose to the United States. So this is not a database that, at least under the current court orders, they could use for any other purpose. I understand the always present and legitimate concern that government may misuse data that it has acquired lawfully. In this case, it's under very strict lock and key and very restricted in terms of its uses. I guess the one other thought I would offer is that the function of protecting the nation and the citizens of the United States from catastrophic foreign attack, which is the purpose of these programs, is a prime function of the federal government under the preamble to the Constitution and is designed to preserve and protect the liberties that the Constitution makes possible, because those liberties would be lost in the event of a catastrophic attack. Or potentially lost. And so protecting the nation from attack is obviously, it has to be weighed against the privacy interests, the legitimate privacy interests of the citizens, and we need to protect those cherished liberties. But those liberties can't survive without effective national defense. So that is the government interest that we're talking about. It's not a trivial one.
But a terrorist attack, even on the scale of 9/11, is not catastrophic. All right, and I'm military, so it's from that perspective of the risk of, let's say that, as with the declaring of hoarding of gold in 1933 or 35, that at some point in time you use metadata, which is really people's personalities, and you use it to come hunt under a new change in the rules. That is a true threat to liberty, and particularly when you look at, we are most likely to create and experience an oil famine here in the next decade as debt and dependence on foreign oil collapse, our access to about 50% of the oil we use every day. in that crisis, a great many things will be done as an emergency procedure. What degree of background data stored over a very long period of time could be used to create incredibly intrusive and anti-liberty activities by the government?
Yeah, I think we do need to be constantly vigilant in that regard.
And we are going to face massive oil supply shocks here very shortly. My guess is when Israel and the Saudis and the Iranians go to war, we have to start paying gold for imported oil, and that'll be a 50% cut in oil access. And that'll create a real lump.
Yeah, this is Dean Reuter interjecting here. Let me ask a question that came by email, and it goes to the expectation of privacy. The emailer questions the conclusion that there really is no expectation of privacy here in this situation, given the level of public outrage that emerged when the data collection program was first disclosed. Do either of you want to address that?
I'd be happy to. Dean, the question raises the fundamental issue of what does the reasonable expectation of privacy test mean? And in my view, it's really important to understand the reasonable expectation of privacy test, also phrased often as the legitimate expectation of privacy test. It's important to see that as a term of art, not a literal test. And a good example is the due process clause. If you want to know if something violates the due process clause, you don't just sort of sit around and ask, you know, is this a process that seems to be due? And just answer it from first principles based on the words in the test. And similarly, with the reasonable expectation of privacy phrase, it's important not to apply that just as a pure literal test, because if you just ask, well, what's reasonable to expect privacy in, that very quickly just becomes, well, I'm a reasonable person. What do I expect privacy in? And our actual expectations of privacy, not constitutional expectations of privacy, but sort of literal expectations of privacy, are hopelessly contingent on the world in which we're in. So, you know, if we don't know that surveillance is occurring, we reasonably expect it's not. If we fear that it is and it's not, we might then no longer have an expectation of privacy because we think it's occurring. Somebody who's paranoid has no expectation of privacy. Somebody who has an unusual sense that everything they're doing is private would think that they have a reasonable expectation of privacy about absolutely everything. That's not how the test works. And I think that's actually another error in Judge Leon's opinion. At some point he says, I can show there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. Look, 54% of Americans that were polled said that they didn't like this program. That's just not what the constitutional test is. Instead, I think you can understand the reasonable expectation of privacy test as a term of art which is trying to ultimately distinguish between government conduct which is particularly invasive, like breaking into a home, breaking into a person's pockets, or surveillance which is not particularly invasive, such as observing somebody in public. And if you look at the Supreme Court's cases on what triggers a reasonable expectation of privacy and what does not, the court seems to be really trying to draw a line between things that are particularly invasive, that raise particular concerns of government overreaching, that are sort of in the context of a government agent watching a person, that break into a private space, that are going too far. And I realize these are very vague terms, but I think that's my best effort to accurately describe what the Supreme Court is doing. So to figure out, does this violate a reasonable expectation of privacy, I think the way of thinking about that is more a structural view about levels of government power rather than just sort of asking, what do I as a reasonable person expect? And that's why I think to answer the Smith versus Maryland question, you really have to go back to what is the level of government power, what are the implications for government power of ruling that metadata access is a search or is not a search. And what makes this a particularly hard question is a lot of people would say, well, in a single case, it should be okay. Doing it on a wide scale, well, that raises concerns. That's where the mosaic argument is coming from. It allows a court to say it's not a search at the small scale level. It is a search at the big scale level. And the difficulty is, how do you ever distinguish between the small scale and the big scale? That's really the knotty problem. So these are very difficult questions in terms of how to draw these lines, but I don't think the answer is in just sort of a colloquial common sense of what do you think it would be reasonable to expect privacy in.
Terrific. We've still got 7 questions in the queue. If you want to add yourself to the queue, we'll try to get through as many as possible. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, my name is Jeff in Orlando. So I have 2 questions, and I'll ask them and let you guys respond and be quiet. You both attack Judge Leon's opinion, but aren't his views the same as the current concurring opinions in Jones, which essentially was the majority if you add them all together? And then secondly, even if Smith v. Maryland does fail and does not apply in a prescribed NSA from collecting data, doesn't the special needs line of cases such as Checkpoint or the code inspectors, Camara and Spitz, allow for the search to satisfy the Fourth Amendment or satisfy or circumvent the Fourth Amendment?
I'll take the first issue. Judge Leon cites and relies heavily on the concurring opinions in Jones. I don't think, you know, some have argued that those concurring opinions amount to kind of a shadow majority opinion. I don't think it works that way, although in the D.C. Circuit, I think the Maynard case, which the Jones concurring opinions draw from, is still good law. So you know, I think Judge Leon should have relied more on the Maynard case, which is binding law in the D.C. Circuit. And those opinions do accept the idea that there's a difference between sort of short-term and long-term monitoring. The difficult question, I think, is what is that distinction in the context of collecting but not analyzing telephone records? Where is the mosaic created if the government knows, say, numbers you are dialing on your telephone? A typical American, I think, makes or receives about 10 telephone calls a day. Does the government collecting but not analyzing those records allow the government to know so much intimate information about you that it's akin to breaking into your house and rifling through your bedroom? Maybe. I don't know exactly how the mosaic test works, but it seems to me that there's potentially significant differences between knowing the 10 phone calls or the numbers dialed by a person on their telephone and following them around and getting information about exactly where they are every few seconds for 28 days. That's going to be an issue that the D.C. Circuit's going to have to consider on appeal. They might agree that the mosaic theory applies to this kind of facts, or they might not. We're just going to have to find out.
I guess I would add that, to me, if it has any legs at all, this mosaic theory under the Fourth Amendment must mean that the mosaic is a mosaic of an individual and an individual's conduct. It's really focused on trying to find out as much information, tracking, if you will, over time, a particular individual. And simply having a vast amount of data that includes the data of millions and millions and millions of individuals doesn't make it a mosaic just because it's large. If you can't show that the government has created this comprehensive mosaic of you personally. And here, I don't think these two plaintiffs, they did not have any basis to take advantage of any theory like that with respect to their own telephone use or their own metadata here or any aspect of their privacy. Their claim to an expectation of privacy or an injury of their privacy interest was simply from the fact that when the government does a query of the database, according to Judge Leon, that query necessarily searches all the numbers in the database to try to find the one terrorist suspect's number and see what it's linked to. And so when they search through all the numbers in the database, necessarily they must search through these two individuals' numbers. Well, I don't think that's creating a mosaic of these individuals. I don't think it's affecting any of their privacy interests simply because their numbers are in the database. So if it is, it's close to zero. If it's not zero, it's as close to zero as you can get, I would think. So I don't see whatever potential the mosaic theory has in case law going forward, I don't see it being implicated here simply because you have a large database. And I think the It's a subject for another call, I'm sure. Interesting problems in the mosaic theory for law enforcement generally and for how government could function and how you could conduct intelligence surveillance, how you could conduct an ordinary police investigation, for example, of an organized crime syndicate, if you can't put a mosaic together from all points of information available to you without a warrant, and putting them together somehow creates a search, that would really throw a monkey wrench into the ability to conduct a lot of the investigations. But that is a subject, I think, for another call.
Did my special needs doctrine point come across?
I'm sorry. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
The Camaro line of case related about the building inspector, so long as there is a master plan of which the creator of the master plan is not conducting the search. And the minimization procedures written by the Attorney General seem to act as that master plan. And so even if it fails under Smith v. Verlin, I think that may be a route the government could use.
Yeah. He did not address – Judge Leon did not address the minimization procedures, at least not extensively. He did address the special use doctrine. So in other words, he did move to the step in the analysis that you're describing. Once he concluded that the plaintiffs had a substantial likelihood of showing a reasonable expectation of privacy here so that this would be a search under the Fourth Amendment, that wasn't the end of it. He then went to the special needs or special uses doctrine to analyze whether a warrant would still be required or whether these quote-unquote searches are reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And I think you're absolutely right. There are border cases. There are lots of cases in special circumstances, and I would submit that national security foreign intelligence gathering is absolutely one of those areas where the government, for purposes of assessing reasonableness, needs to be able to conduct surveillance without getting a warrant, and especially so here where the putative infringement on privacy interests is so relatively small. So there are lots of aspects to that doctrine that Judge Leon did not address, and I think are reasons for criticizing his approach to that aspect of the issue.
Well, gentlemen, we have more questions pending than ever. We've got 10 people on the line with questions. We're going to try and get to as many as possible. I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible in their questions. So here we go.
Yes, my name is Nick Curry. I'm a businessman in New Jersey, and I'm just speaking as a citizen concerned about the power that's increasing in the executive branch. And my concern is basically if the executive branch can now be in contempt of Congress with respect to Fast and Furious, the Justice Department and the FBI can be in contempt of Congress with the IRS targeting scandal, and you have heads of national intelligence can lie to Congress and nothing can happen to them. What assurance does a citizen have at all that this kind of power won't be abused? Because it seems to me it's not a choice between security and civil liberties, but it's between security and the potential for totalitarianism in a crisis. I mean, what is there for me to be assured that when Justice Roberts suddenly switched his decision on Obamacare, he didn't get a call in the middle of the night based on this type of data, and that this kind of thing cannot happen in the future when you have it in that kind of power in the hands of an administration that is that is so uncooperative and seemingly unwilling to be transparent about what they're doing, as well as intelligence agencies lying to a branch of our federal government.
Well, the point you're raising is really one about government trust. And, you know, it's a tricky question in part because the government is not an it, it's a they. It consists of millions of different potential government employees doing many different things, and most of us would say too many things. And so it's hard, you know, to say, you know, when should you trust or not trust the government on any of these issues. I think, you know, Judge Leon's decision is apart from that because it is just a Fourth Amendment ruling. It's a constitutional question, not the broader policy issue, although clearly, you know, the questions of how the underlying question here, really, I think the critical question on this debate is where do we go from here as a policy matter? What reforms of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act are proper or are improper? And hopefully we can enact reforms which help address some of the concerns that you raised.
Let's take another question.
Hi, Larry Callahan. Good morning or good afternoon. One quick background. I spent 3 years in the Army with the Defense Communications Agency of the DOD. I then went to law school. I then was in the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco, and I worked on Title III's, on pen registers, and also worked with the FBI and the Soviet Consulate in San Francisco. So when I left to went to D.C. at DOJ and was in legislative, I worked on Title III. I am not an engineer. I have not read the opinion. So I'm not totally familiar. I'm familiar with a lot of this, but I haven't read the opinion. I don't quite understand some of this. I understand Mosaic, and that's quickly, and I'll do this very quickly. If you're doing a criminal case, normally you're going to start out with a surveillance or an undercover conversations. You will do that, use that information in order to get possibly a pen register or just get maybe a Title III warrant, but usually you get a pen register. A pen register gives you megadata. It gives you the phone numbers that came in and the phone numbers go out and who those belong to. You can then use that information to get a Title III warrant. What Title III warrant under 25, 11, 12, and 13 of Title 18 allows you to do is to listen and intercept and record the communications. With FISA, you have a different process and you go to the special court and get permission to do all sorts of other things. If I understand this correctly, what is being recorded here is information that is on someone's telephone bill, in addition to the fact of recording, but also detailing the person called or the person receiving the call, but nothing else at this point. If that is accurate, what is he saying is the violation of the Fourth Amendment? Because what is the, as I said, I should have read the case, but on what basis does he say that now you can, you didn't need warrants to get a, by the way, you don't need a warrant really to get a pen register. You certainly don't need a Title III warrant, but the standard of probable cause is far less, and it kind of increases as you go along. So I don't quite understand what the problem is here, other than people, and I understand people's interest in privacy, but that's different than having a legal standard. Thank you.
You know, I think it's not under Judge Leon's decision. He's effectively said that Smith versus Maryland is no longer good law. It would seem to be the case that a warrant or maybe a Title III order is required to do a pen register now, at least a pen register for a long period of time. Judge Leon effectively is saying that, yes, it's only a pen register, but pen registers today are different from pen registers in 1979 because we use cell phones when we make phone calls, not landline phones, and therefore Smith versus Maryland is no longer good law.
That was
the reasoning.
Or does he really say Smith is no longer good law, or does he really try to distinguish it?
It says it's no longer valid in a cell phone, given our cell phone-centric society.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you will, it's almost like he's declaring the death of Smith versus Maryland, that it's obsolete in the modern world. But I will say he also adds as an element of his reasoning the vastness of the database and the potential ability of the NSA to draw connections among all of the data in the database. So that's an element. It's difficult to put that together as coherent reasoning with the cell phones are new, smartphones are new, and multifunction argument. But he does have both of those points in support of his conclusion that somehow this is a search, whereas the pen register in the Smith case was not.
I want to advise our audience as well that on our international law practice group conference call, we've decided to take a much closer look at the NSA stuff. So we'll be having more calls like this in the future. But for now, let's continue.
Can I just add real quickly? Everyone should look up today's New York Times. Obama is urged to sharply curb NSA data mining by Sanger and Savage. Interesting article.
All right, let's take one more question, and then we'll have to adjourn. So let's take another question.
Prior to the Communications Assistance Law Enforcement Act in 1994, you did have an expectation of privacy because the people who held all this data was the telephone company. It wasn't the government. And the government had to go to the telephone company, which was reluctant to give up people's privacy because they wanted people to have confidence that when they made a phone call, that the government wouldn't be listening willy-nilly. And so you had to get a warrant to listen to a phone call, and you had to go to the phone company to retrieve this data from them. The 1994 Act gave the government the capability to do this from a room in the FBI. And the libertarians at that time said this is a really bad thing because there's no check and balance on them. They can just do this at will, and there's nothing to police them. And so if there's any reduction in the expectation of privacy, it's because the FBI and the NSA have breached their promise not to invade the privacy without a warrant, and they're doing it without telling anybody. And I think they ought to repeal the Law Enforcement Act of 1995.
The Supreme Court is actually.
I was just going to say, in this case, they do have to get a court order, and they are going to the company with an order. They're not doing it directly from some room at the NSA or the FBI. So, in other words, this is the under the kind of construct that you described, where they have to get prior court approval to get the metadata, and they have to go with an order to the company to collect it. I'm sorry, Oren, you were going to jump in.
Oh yeah, in fact, in Smith versus Maryland, it was that was a case where there was no court order, and that was before CALEA, Smith versus Maryland from 1979. And the Supreme Court has rejected the idea that statutory privacy laws can create or eliminate Fourth Amendment rights. Again, the reasonable expectation of privacy issue is not sort of what would you expect based on the current state of the law. Instead, it's this broader sort of normative judgment that the justices are making about government power, and whether rightly or wrongly. And some have criticized the reasonable expectation of privacy test, Justice Scalia most strongly. But that's what the test currently allows, and it doesn't fluctuate based on the current state of statutory privacy law, at least based on the court's cases.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I apologize to callers on the line that haven't had a chance to ask their questions, and I do promise we'll revisit this issue in the very near future. To our audience, I also want to – well, let me thank Steve Bradbury and Professor Oren Kerr for your time today. We certainly appreciate your comments. To the audience, I encourage you to join us for our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. When we'll be discussing the newly issued Volcker Rule. But until then, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.